Welcome to Midrats with Sal from Commander Salamander and Eagle One from Eagle Speak at Sea or Shore, your home for a discussion of national security issues and all things maritime. And welcome aboard, everybody. I am the aforementioned Sal, along with my co-host, the ever-genial Eagle One of Eagle Speak, both with you today. And we are live, so if you are with that esteemed cohort that made the extra effort to arrange your schedules to be with you, I'd like to be with us. I would like to invite you to scroll down to the bottom of the show page. That's where you will find a link to the chat room. We've already got four folks in there that will be glad to welcome you on board. And if that is a great venue, in case you have any questions you would like for us to address to our guest, or you just have some observations you'd like to share with everybody else during the course of the show, that is the perfect place to do it. And on today's show, it's going to be a great Midrats because we're having one of our friends come back to talk with us. And we're going to talk about a subject that if you ever find yourself at a table full of navalists, if they're the right kind, you roll out this one word and you got at least a 45-minute conversation out of it, if not longer, depending on how many adult beverages you have on the table. But we're going to talk about presence today. Everybody says it's a naval mission. It's gone by that various names for a few thousand years, but in the modern context, that's what we refer it to. We'll dig into a little bit of the history over the course of the next hour about what it meant, what it means now, and what we need to look at towards the future if this is something that is important for the world's premier naval power, depending on how you measure it, going forward for the rest of the century. And we'll also probably touch on things that you can do to properly resource that if it's not properly resourced the way we want it to right now. And joining us today is returning guest Dr. Jerry Hendricks, Captain U.S. Navy retired. He is the president of Hendricks & Associates. And on the show page, you'll find a link to the document that he authored recently with some assistance with a good group of folks you can read about on the inside cover for the Sagamore Institute titled Measuring and Modeling Naval Presence. Jerry, welcome back to Midrats.
It's great to be here, and it's great to be with this particular audience talking about this report, because I think that if anyone is going to have, one, a grasp of what I was trying to accomplish and also the ability to pick it apart, it's not only these you two hosts, but also your audience.
Well, we will do our best to meet that high standard, but it's always great when you have somebody who's authored a book or a report like this, because the opening question is at least the easiest for the host to do, give you a chance to set the table some. Tell us about your report. What will the reader find in it?
Well, so I set out and proposed almost 2 years ago now to actually the Smith Richardson Foundation that we find a way of measuring the value of naval presence. We say it's important. The regional combatant commander says it's important. We've written about it for the better part of 50 years now as a mission of the Navy. And yet when we say, well, what is it worth? How do you measure it? It's so much as a hand wave or the ultimate these aren't the droids you're looking for type of moment. It's more ephemeral even than the idea of those definitions of a pornography that the Supreme Court would say, you know, I'll know it when I see it. And so I thought that there should be something more to this. And despite the fact as an analyst, I had been looking for, beyond just a definition of naval presence, but some means to measure it, whether there was a model of it, for the better part of the last 5 years, and I did not find it. So I made this proposal that to Smith Richardson Foundation that I would set about to go and try and create a model that could be placed into a computer simulation, and that we could then try to determine the value of various different platforms or formations of Navy ships. Smith Richardson found it very intriguing. They enthusiastically embraced it. I will tell you that we went back and forth several times on this because originally I proposed that I would come up with a model of the presence for the new Constellation class frigate, which has always intrigued me. But due to members of the reviewing committee at Smith Richardson, we actually came back and said, no, you will model the Arleigh Burke class destroyer, the ubiquitous sort of centerpiece of the U.S. Navy, and then, you know, go forward from there and also try to figure out, you know, how, you know, if you're modeling, you know, you have to model it against something else. And so we very carefully looked at the Lu Yang 2 from the People's Liberation Army Navy. And then the more I got into it, I began to realize that you can't really create a model without also trying to find some way of measuring the environment because there's various different types. So anyways, I underwent about 18 months of research where I reviewed the historical literature associated with this. I interviewed six former regional combatant commanders, three Navy, two Army, one Air Force, to get their views on naval presence, and then also with several modeling and simulation experts, individuals from Purdue University, the Naval Postgraduate School, as well as the Santa Fe Institute of Modeling and Simulation. I also talked with a sort of a very ancient war gamer who had actually created some of the original Atari software and then did some models and simulations in the 1990s on diplomacy. And then out of that generated this model that's got, you know, an algorithm in it that runs through, and we were able to sort of run through the Burke class versus the Lu Yang in several different environments and sort of test some of these things. So it was a very long, drawn-out process. It was very uncomfortable for me as a humanities major to do this, but in the end, I was quite pleased with the final report.
Yeah, I think when I first looked at this, Jerry, that I was stunned by how audacious you were in taking on this task, because I didn't see any way to measure presence as an end result of this. Now, I think some of this was driven, I guess, because I was reading Bob Work's piece from Proceedings about the Navy's overzealous approach to presence, and Admiral Fogo's response to that. But I think what you've done is really provide a tool, as I understand what your goal was. You're not necessarily a complete answer, but a tool for someone to use. And who is that someone?
Well, so a great, you know, first of all, great observation. And if you, you know, for those who get a chance to read the report, you will note as I go through the literature review that I talk about those who are for naval presence and those who are against. And Bob Work gets about 2.5 pages of the report for his essay on the slavish devotion to naval presence and how it's breaking the Navy, which I know Mr. Work. I respect him tremendously. I consider him a mentor and friend, but I disagreed with that essay. And so in many ways, this proposal to Smith Richardson came out of my response, somewhat knee-jerk, emotional response to that essay and Proceedings. But in reality, and you're perceptive to point out, I don't actually come up with the conclusion in this report. I don't suggest what the alternative fleet structure and architecture should look like because I wanted the model to be there and in the hope that someone else would pick it up. Now, who is that someone else? I can tell you that the three entities I would like is one N81 inside the Pentagon's OPNAV staff that they would pick up this model and fund having it run through a succession of iterations. I would also suggest that either Fleet Forces Command or the U.S. Pacific Fleet pick up the model. Fund it, adapt it, you know, work with the staffs at the Naval Postgraduate School or any other modeling and simulation academic centers, you know, to build this out and then run these tests. I was quite frankly frustrated that no one had done something like this before. And then as I moved my way through this, I came away somewhat suspicious that perhaps someone had, and that the results of running these models in the past may have not come out in line with current fleet architecture and budgetary decisions. So I believe that this type of work needs to be done. I believe that the fleet could look significantly different and perhaps even have a different price point if someone were to pick this model up and run with it. And the three entities I mentioned, quite frankly, I think maybe the SecNav with his new analysis shop could be another entity could pick this up. But, you know, I did this really with relatively little financial resources. And I think, you know, if someone took it and put a larger team and more financial resources behind it and a little time in a supercomputer, they could come up with something that would be quite illuminating.
Yeah, for those that have, again, the link is at the show page if folks don't have the report up. Towards the end, and I may be getting ahead of ourselves. That's okay. It's our show. We can do what we want to. But you get to the modeling portion at the end, Jerry, and I thought what was nice about this is, yes, there is math there that our friend Mark Vandroff would like to roll around in. There are little delta signs and a couple other Greek numbers in there. But it's understandable. You don't have to have a 100-pound math head to understand it because, you know, I'm like you. I come from the other side of the brain. But in this discussion that we have about naval missions and presence, I think what was nice about this and where this can be used as a tool by others is a lot of this, and we talked about this on other subjects and offline as well, a lot of this is telling a story. And humans are right brain or left brain people. They're not better or worse depending upon how they look at things. They're just different, which is great. Some people, they need to be told a story. And that's where, you know, the liberal arts side of explaining things, but also there is, and especially in a highly technical area like the Navy, there are people who think in numbers, they think in graphs, and they need to have it explained with some metrics. And this offers a tool. And I think well-meaning people can look at what's offered here and say, you know, this variable is off by, you know, it's not 4.6, it should be a 5.7. Okay, fine, argument. But you've created a structure here, and I think you're right, that, you know, people can take this model and they can customize it as they wish. But at the end of the day, it can bring on additional conversations, additional storytelling. So you're able to communicate to people who think both ways, both one side of the brain or the other, because, you know, you mentioned, you know, for the last 40 years, and another valuable part that you find in the early part of the report is there's some history here. The presence mission, as it's modernly constructed, goes back to early 1970s in Stansfield Turner. But you rightfully point out, and I like how you structured the errors of the last ERAS, of the last century, where we went from command of the sea to the Cold War power projection era to the from the sea era, and what we now call presence. Different generations of people thinking about the Navy and naval power, they use influence, showing the flag, demonstrations, and then finally at presence. And the one thing that came up, and I think it's a byproduct of the critique that you brought on. I know Barney Rubble and Bob Work, who you just mentioned, were two of the critics of it. And having both prior guests on Midrats, I might want to say, up over the years and talk to them. A lot of their critique, I think a lot of the critique of the presence mission really is, and please tell me if I'm off here, it's almost a byproduct of the frustration that we can't do it simply because we don't have the numbers. And something, if you do a letter search in the document, but you don't have to because it's so obvious, a number comes up constantly, which I think is related to Rubble and Work's critiques about, you know, wearing out a Navy that goes from readiness focus to a deployment focus. And that number is between 130 and 150 ships at sea. That keeps coming up in your research and your discussions. Talk a little bit about that number of 130 and 150, and when you reverse engineer that, where that comes up with some numbers that should be familiar to most listeners here on Midrange.
Well, I mean, the history of this is, you know, first of all, naval presence as a mission has almost always inherently been there. In fact, there was a great quote that I used from Oliver Cromwell that a line of battleship is perhaps a nation's best ambassador. So this idea of using ships as a means of messaging or influencing was right there. I mean, obviously, you know, even Mahan's seminal work, The Influence of Sea Power Upon History, is about influence, this idea of our ability to manipulate or massage the environment around us through the introduction of naval platforms and hence the introduction of our interests, demonstration of our interest in a particular region. The reason why presence came out in a more articulate way in the early 1970s, first with Stansfield Turner and then also from Edward Lutwak's early paper on suasion, the idea of naval presence as a suasion, is because the Navy leadership at that time, Elmer Zumwalt and then his very close acolyte Lieutenant Stansfield Turner, then president of the Naval War College, were looking at the declining number of ships. And so, you know, we had come out of World War II with 1,000 ships. Eisenhower sort of necked us down to about 900. We kept that 900 through about 1968. But as the cost of the Vietnam War started to mount, those ships also started to age, we began to see the size of the fleet decline. Well, the problem was, is during the Cold War in the 1950s, 60s, and into the 70s, the Navy either had signed up for or had been volunteered for a number of these presence missions, you know, these regional combatant commanders, whether it was Pacific Command or whether it was EUCOM or whether it was any of the other things that started to grow up. They all wanted these ships to show up, and they'd set these schedules and put in their requests. And so we had to maintain about 130 to 150 ships at sea at any given time during this time period in order to service these requests from the four stars around the world. And also the political leaders had begun to really lean on the Navy for messaging. And, you know, and of course, the ultimate case was the Cuban Missile Crisis, where we used the Atlantic Fleet, combined second and sixth fleets, to essentially send this dramatic message to Khrushchev. And there was a lot of control over the political importance or the tone that was set even with that. But there were all these other different incidents where we were using ships to send signals. And so in 73, Turner and Zumwalt are like, hey, look, the fleet's coming down. I still got this demand signal to be out here with 130 to 150 ships on any given day, and I don't have the ships to do it. Something's going to have to give. And so because we had never spoken of presence before, suddenly we started speaking about it. And it was a clarion call to the political leadership that if you find value in this, in using the Navy in this way, you're going to have to invest in the Navy. Well, pretty soon someone did. You know, when Ronald Reagan runs in 1980, you know, he runs explicitly on a 600-ship Navy because he had, you know, his trusty deputy there, John Lehman, who had spent the 4 years between the Carter administration coming in and Reagan coming in, sort of getting his ducks in a row about what size of fleet we need and how we would use it. And so we built that Navy back up to 594 ships, and we were out there to meet that 130 to 150 ships. And this audience knows, you know, to keep, you know, 130 to 150 ships at sea, you need about four times the number of ships. So that's 600. So that's the reason why these arguments started being laid out, is that we had to come up with the fleet behind the 130 to 150 per day. And so that's where that came from.
Well, let's talk a little bit about a definition of presence and what you use to work through to get to the formulas you developed in your work. Because presence means a lot of different things to different, as you talk to your COCOMs, they all seemed kind of nonplussed, maybe the right word, to have to answer that question. I mean, we assume a lot of stuff about presence, but What did you find in your work as what a good definition of naval presence is?
Well, before I get into the good definition, let's talk about the interview with the COCOMs first, because that was an eye-opener for me. When I jumped into this, I wanted to make sure I spoke with several COCOMs. The second thing I wanted to do was I was kind of interested to see how they viewed it based upon their service backgrounds. And so, you know, I interviewed three retired Navy admirals, William Fox Fallon, Harry Harris, and Jim Stavridis. But I also interviewed Mike Scafriati, Army General, Carter Ham, Army General, and Phil Breedlove, Air Force General. What I found in asking them their questions, and I gave the same 12 questions to each one of them in order, just to keep a standard in the way that I was approaching them, was that in many ways, the Navy guys gave, with the exception of Stavridis in many ways, gave me sort of more what I would almost term canned answers. And I don't mean that in a negative way. It's that they had grown up in this culture. They had grown up with this terminology. They were talking with me, a retired Navy captain who they are familiar with. And so in many ways, there was sort of a hand wave and a shorthand conversation back and forth about a lot of these talks. In many ways, the conversations with the Navy retired COCOMs were shorter in terms of length than they were with the Army and Air Force. What I found with the Army and Air Force was that because this was a new tool for them, it was something that they had to study, they were much more articulate about their answers to this. They had taken the time later in their career intellectually to grasp the concepts of presence, how they would use it. When the Navy staff would come in and brief them about presence missions, I got the sense that they were more engaged. And so they were taking the time, and not to mention, they knew who I was, retired Navy captain, PhD, and I think they wanted to demonstrate to me that they had a grasp of this topic that we were going to talk about in this hour, hour and a half long conversation. And so I found it interesting that they were willing to dive down and again, be much more articulate in this. Now, the idea of the definition of naval presence, you know, is very much, this idea of both, you know, active and latent presence. This idea that presence is there to provide influence in the region and presence is really measured in the reaction of the environment to your arrival. And so presence in many ways is defined by, you know, who you are and what you're bringing to the area, and also whether you're coming in a proactive or in a reactive manner. And so we get into that, you know, within the literature review section of this. And it also shows up later when we start building the model about, because there's, you know, a physical characteristic to presence, but there's also an ephemeral characteristic to presence. And we had to find a way of sort of measuring both and then integrating them.
Yeah, along that vein, you know, of presence and showing up, one of the things that had me thinking about something I was like, God, why hadn't I thought of that before, is as you discuss about the reaction to presence, it's not a binary thing where you're there, you're not, and there's just a nuance. You know, the old argument, you know, can submarines do the presence mission if you can't see them type of thing is deeper than that. It's psychological. So it really is a multidisciplinary approach to understanding this, because you outline a bit that it's just not you're there as a presence, but who you are. Are you from a nation that has a 300-ship Navy or a 50-ship Navy? You know, the Japanese versus the American Arleigh Burke class destroyer, you know, on paper, same ship, but, you know, what is that addition to that modifier? But, you know, so that's what you bring with you when you show up and where you're coming from. So a lot of the, it sounds harsh to call it a coping mechanism, because I actually believe part of it, but the discussions of a 1,000-ship Navy or being able you know, yes, we only have X number of ships, but our allies have navies like this. One does not equal one in that regard when you're looking at the president's mission. Describe a little bit how those variables can change when, if you look at a map that just says there are two blue destroyers there, that doesn't mean that number really equals two.
Yeah, so you just raised up about four things there, and let me kind of cycle back and go through them because they're all interesting points of the conversation. The first point is sort of talking about the impact, and that presence isn't just being there, but in fact, presence has a bow wave. There's an anticipatory aspect of presence, a temporal, and it also has a residual that after a ship leaves. You know, I actually compared it to a radioactive half-life within it. There are incidents, you know, for instance, the visit of the battleship Missouri to Turkey in Constantinople back during the 1940s is still spoken of today in that broader Black Sea region. Same thing with the passage of the carrier strike groups through the Taiwan Straits in the mid-1990s. Although that occurred, you know, some 35 years ago, 38 years ago, that still has a residual effect. So there's very much like this isotopial half-life aspect of these things, depending on how you do it. The second thing I would say is, interestingly enough, in a lot of the research and review of the professional literature, is that a lot of the thinkers who had written about this in the past made the point that the arrival and departure of ships in almost always has a bigger impact than ships that are just there. So Ken Booth and Edward Lutwak, both in their treatments of presence, talk about the fact that, you know, for instance, the FDNF force in the Western Pacific may not be as influential as, let's say, a fleet surging out from the West Coast to surge over and arrive into the arena, that would have more presence because it's causing a change in the environment. It's perceived as a change in the background, ambient noise in the environment, rather than the fact that Desron 15, simply by its existence there, sort of has faded into the background noise. It is part of the status quo, and that presence is very much about changing the status quo. And so you get into a lot of these different types of conversations about what is effective naval presence, you know, in the way that you present it. And we have to be in many ways much more articulate about the way that we use our assets.
Yeah. I'm sitting here looking at a map that shows where our ships are. And, you know, right now we've got the Ford and the Eisenhower in the Middle East. The Eisenhower was there, the Ford showed up recently or vice versa. I can't remember the order, but did the impact of bringing that, in your view of presence, did the impact of bringing that second carrier as a message to the neighborhood, is that had more impact than just we had a carrier kind of there already?
Well, what was interesting about that is that, Eagle One, is that the research showed, and this even predates in the 1970s, there was a number of studies on this, is that moving from one carrier in an area to two carriers did not double your naval presence value in that region. That it was more of like a moving from a 1.0 to a 1.5 in the way that it was perceived. However, three carriers in a region demonstrated an exponential rise because there was a perception or an understanding that three large deck aircraft carriers provided you with an opportunity to go 24/7 with carrier operations. And then they were aware of this. They knew that one deck had an ability to essentially fly 10 to 12 hours a day. Two decks had the ability to perhaps go 24 hours a day, but perhaps only for 5 days. But three decks gives you ability to cycle those carriers in such a way as that you can now provide 24/7. So when we surge four strike groups over to the Middle East after Saddam Hussein's invasion of Kuwait in 1990. That was seen as a shout, a very loud shout in the international environment. But surging one carrier into a region is not necessarily a big deal. So what I would say is that stationing the Ford off the east coast of off the west coast of Israel certainly got someone's attention. But when the word was out that the Ike was coming over the hill, well, then suddenly people were beginning to get nervous. And then when I think it was Carl Vincent took off from the west coast, it's either Vincent or Stennis that started moving out across the west coast, and everybody started to watch, I think, in the international arrival to see what's the deal with that west coast carrier? What's going on with that deployer? Where is it going? Because if the Americans start showing up with 3.0, well, hey, game on at that point in time, and that's the way that's perceived, even within the model.
Yeah, I'll go ahead and quote from the report for you kiddies who have your hymnal handy. It's at the top of page 47. It's a quote, modern policymakers understand that if four carrier strike groups operating together is a war cry, one amphibious ready group is a growl, and a surfacing submarine in the right place is a terrifying lethal whisper, unquote. I thought that was a great outline. I plan on using that in the future. But you also brought something in that I think goes into that. Again, you know, numbers don't matter. What they are in intent, but also there's the perception of it. And believe it or not, there's something about dinosaurs and everything. But you brought in the concept of something you learned from your daughters that you, I don't know if you coined it, but it's the Ceratopean impact.
Yeah.
Ceratopean advantage, I think it is.
Yeah. So this is actually, I get more reaction to this part of the paper, this one page that I wrote up about my daughters and their online gaming community. Almost everyone notices it. So I have two daughters. Both are adults. One is a practicing paleontologist at a dinosaur museum in North Dakota, and the other one is a sophomore this year studying wildlife biology up in Maine. And so, but these two sisters get together online like every night, and they play a game called the Visa Bermuda, which is a dinosaur, and they have dinosaur avatars in the game. And so I'm listening in on them because they talk with each other on Discord, and no one messes with the Hendrix girls in this environment. But one of the things that I found was that they prefer to play as ceratopsians, essentially large herbivores, the cows, as it were, of the dinosaur community, rather than sort of the larger, more sexy, more lethal Tyrannosaurus rex or Velociraptors, which everyone seems to pay attention to. And I finally said, well, why are you doing that? And they said, well, because the ceratopsians, each one of them has a very inherent intimidation or intim score. And that if we operate together, everyone stays away from us because, you know, acting as a herd, we can intimidate them. And in fact, if someone messes with us, we get a large enough herd and we'll just circle this carnivore diet or this carnivore dinosaur, and we will kill them through intimidation. And it's like, wow, that's pretty amazing. So my key thing was is I wanted to know how in that computer game did they mathematically model intimidation? How did they actually write the code into that analog to be able to do that? And I started trying to work with them as well as the game designers to figure that out because they found that really intriguing. But this idea of maintaining the peace through lethal, you know, intimidation, the ability that I don't want you to mess with me, but I need to be large enough and strong enough, and then I need to combine my effects in such a way that you won't jump ugly with me. And so that particular game really convinced me that, in fact, this thing, naval presence, actually can be modeled. And so that had encouraged me in my own research.
Yeah, I was laughing at that part because I was thinking, you know, we often are sending things like LCSs into areas where we want to intimidate, and I can't think of a less intimidating ship right now. So, you know, I think one of the good aspects of your research is that somebody on one of these staffs has got to think, should be thinking, well, yeah, I got to add in intimidation, and We need to have something bigger and better than an LCS out there patrolling an area.
Can I stop you right there? Because one of the things that's important to understand is that up until the early 1980s, in none of the literature dealing with either influence or presence or suasion or any of the different words or phrases we use, no one spoke about the naval presence value of destroyers or cruisers up until the 1980s. It was either, if you talked about presence, you were either talking about carrier strike groups or you were talking about marine amphibious ready groups, carriers or ARGs. And then suddenly in the 1980s, then we started talking about destroyers like Spruance class destroyers or Ticonderoga class cruisers, or quite frankly, you talked about the battleships as well. And why was that? And it was because, and I went into the literature, I reviewed it, it was explicitly because of the integration of the Tomahawk land attack missile into the inventory of those ships. And so the moment that you put a power projection weapon on board a vessel, and then I would submit that LCS could actually have a presence capability if, in fact, you had an ability to project power from it that actually held your competitor's interests at risk. But if you have a vessel out there that essentially is just a seagoing vessel that can only operate or influence the immediate water area around it, it does not exert a presence on the environment. You really need that power projection capability to make the other guy sit up and listen to you or pay attention to you. So it was Tomahawk that I think changed the way that we valued presence in the fleet. And the Spruikans and then the Tycos and ultimately the Burks are all considered to be presence vehicles today, despite the fact that they would not have been during the 60s and 70s.
Yeah, it goes back to something that I think we could do an entire show on, and you know, something you and I, Jerry, talked about before. Range matters. It's underappreciated in so many things involving the Navy. But we talked about, let's go back to the original 70s. And for the listeners, they're probably aware of Stansfield Turner. They could remember to Google some of the stuff that he wrote. It's all available online. We've discussed Zumwalt. But there are two other people who are part of this discussion. They're kind of on a similar school that I would encourage the listeners to look up, and I wanted to get your take on their perspective of it. And that was in 1971, there was James Cable's Gunboat Diplomacy, and also Commander James McNulty at the time, he had an initial reply to Stanfield Turner's earlier work on presence mission, where he argued for, we can see echoes in influence squadrons here, the value of more numerous ships for the mission vice just these large, nuclear era Cold War units that most people were thinking about when they talked about presence.
Well, so Cable wrote an entire book on gunboat diplomacy, and did a really great study, mostly of the British Empire. And its use of small vessels and medium-sized vessels and cruisers to sort of uphold its diplomacy. And obviously he even made the point that this term, gunboat diplomacy, cuts both ways. It's a two-edged sword because it was viewed both positively and negatively. So, the idea that, we're going to, put these gunboats up on some of the rivers of China, there's a lot of imperial overtones that go along with that were viewed very negatively. But I think he did a great job of historically sort of reviewing some of these policies. By the way, I think that Captain B.J. Armstrong out of the United States Naval Academy has just recently done this as well with his book about American naval operations in the 19th and early 20th century, and looking at presence missions there. I think that BJ's kind of come alongside Cable's book and sort of provided an addendum, an annex, further exploration of it, which is not surprising because BJ and I actually worked on a paper on naval presence almost a decade ago when I was at the Center for New American Security called the Presence Problem, where we started to first map out our interest in this topic. Now, McNulty, you know, looks at this, and again, he's critiquing this idea that, you know, about what the implications are here, which is numbers. And, you know, I think that he's actually calling us out about that. Isn't this an argument for numbers at this point in time? And then he also wants to understand that, you know, that the modern world was fundamentally different than the pre-World War II world because of nuclear weapons. And he wanted to make sure that we were understanding that the oceans were no longer barriers, but in fact part of a global environment that we're all operating in. But he thought that the Navy was making wrong-headed decisions then, that if presence was what we were going to be doing, our investment in more technical, high-end ships, as we were starting to make huge investments in the Ticonderoga and Aegis at that time, was going to price us out of the ability to do the presence mission in the long run, that we needed a force that had a lot of cheaper vessels that we can buy in bigger numbers. If you were really going to do presence, you really needed to pay attention to the low end of the high-low mix.
Yeah, that strikes me. I mean, here we are talking about surge being important, that if you can surge forth power, you know, I'm thinking, well, you know, the easiest and least problematic way to have a force that surges is if you have nuclear-powered ships. So the carriers, the days when we had nuclear-powered cruisers, I think nuclear-powered destroyers, a few of them, but we had a whole bunch of those nuke cruisers. You know, that seems to me you could, if the concern is that Bob Work had, which was that we can't maintain our force and use it at the same time, that if you need a force you can surge, that you want a force that you can send that doesn't have a big logistics train behind it, those types of ships would be very important to them. But and I would think that somewhere would be worked into your formula as a part of the environment.
Yeah, so it's actually there. So in the formula, there's an area that deals with sustainability, sustainment. So it's part of the ephemeral side of the equation, but the ability of a nation to support its forward deployed forces at sea for sustained periods of time. And I actually raised the point that the U.S., that really the ability to do underway replenishment, specifically replenishment alongside, is sort of the, you know, where you can figure out who the major league players are versus AAA and AA. And that one of the things that I'm really disturbed about is that China's increasing proficiency in underway replenishment and the growth, their ability to just add replenishment ships and tenders and sustainment because of their large shipbuilding industry. So when I scored that out, you know, I made the point that, you know, while we are very good at underway replenishment and we have a strong tradition with sustainment, we're facing a problem in that the percentage of the sustainment part of our fleet is getting smaller and there's more stress upon it. And that we're not paying enough attention to that side of the fleet equation. And so, you know, China's is looking at that as much as we are, and I'm looking as much at the size of their sustainment fleet and their ability to have overseas bases and hubs, logistical support hubs, to support their operations. So, yes, sustainment and logistics is a very large portion of the ephemeral side of the conversation.
I think something else, you know, we're talking about explaining this problem, and we have the wargaming, for lack of a better phrase, that yeah, as you try to work this out and game the system, look at the different variables that were going in, but there's also trying to visualize it because it's part of telling the story. And an interesting way to look at it, a lot of people who look at a variety of statistics, one way they graph things, is a thing, you know, heat maps, looking at crime rates, for instance. You can pull up a city and it has the various heat maps. And you came in an interesting way as you come through this algorithm that you've developed, which, you know, people can fiddle around with it if they want to. You know, how do you visualize this? How do you explain this? And, you know, going back to interdisciplinary ways of explaining things, you actually tapped into the meteorology side of the house. What are other ways of visualizing the outcomes of this exercise you think might be useful to help more people understand what you're trying to explain to them?
Well, ultimately, the model that I'm using is an agent-based model. And so there's a number of characteristics of that particular modeling that are important. But the key thing is that I settled on a concept that's called emergence, which is that it's nearly impossible, you know, to one-for-one model every aspect of an environment. And so you have to focus on certain key characteristics of the environment and say that I'm going to zero in on this, I'm going to measure that, and those factors will be representative. So, for instance, you know, the weather is perhaps, you know, the most complex thing on the planet. Very difficult, you know, to try and model if you tried to go one for one because there's just so many variables. However, meteorologists for years have noted that if you look at temperature and wind direction and speed and humidity, that in fact you get a fairly representative model of the weather. And by, so you get temperature, barometric pressure, wind direction and speed. So those things right there are going to tell you, you know, what that weather looks like. And we see that every night on the 6 o'clock news in the last 10 minutes. So as I started to bring this out, and by the way, there's a couple other things that emerge, you know, that would be very similar. Like there's a model that was done on forest fires, and based upon the density of a forest and how many trees and how close they are, you can create that and you can see what the proclivity of a particular forest is to kind of have a flash fire that cannot be, controlled. Or for that matter, there's some other things that do modeling dealing with earthquakes that based upon the number of volcano reactions, you can tell what the likelihood is of an earthquake in an area. A lot of small volcano reactions will lead to a lesser of large earthquakes and vice versa. So there's a number of these emergence factors that I came across when I was doing the reading. And so that allowed me to try and form in my own mind both sort of broad categories of the physical characteristics of naval presence, and then also some broad categories of what we would call the non-corporeal or the ephemeral characteristics of naval presence. And so, and those were what I used to kind of drill deep. So, for instance, you know, on the physical characteristics, I looked at the lethality, the awareness, the readiness, and the range of the platforms of the navies, carriers, cruisers, destroyers, frigates, and corvettes or the littoral combat ship. Lethality is essentially a measurement of how much ordnance, is on board, how much hurt can that particular platform visit upon someone else. Its awareness is the sensory awareness around it, both in the air, in space, under the sea, how aware of its environment, how far can that awareness stretch out? And so I assign scores to that. The readiness of the platform, obviously that goes to training of the crew as well as the material condition of the vessel itself. And then, of course, range. So what is its ability to exert lethality at a distance? And so I use that to generate platform scores for all these things within it. And then you turn, because that's just the physical characteristics. You have to then pass those characteristics through what I call the national lens, which are these more ephemeral characteristics, things like national will, combat credibility, the size of the fleet, the sustainment ability of that fleet, the economic security of the nation, and ultimately an alliance score. So what can it draw upon in the international environment? And bringing all these things together with weighted average across those characteristics, Then you take those two things, physical and non-physical characteristics, and you have to compete them in the environment. And I actually defined six environments on the ocean in which we competed. And those environments have different levels of resistance or what I would call viscosity you know, that are helpful to us or helpful to the other guy, and you sort of have to factor in those scores, you know, as we did. So that got into that aspect of the model and agent-based, you know, characteristics of how to approach this.
Yeah, I was looking at it, at this stuff and thinking, okay, where are where do you add in threats like the shore-based anti-ship cruise missiles that exist now, and what factor do you use for our own air assets? You know, those Air Force guys who are worldwide operators, of course. You know, in certain environments, where did you factor those in? Is that also part of the environment stuff?
It is, and in fact, that goes to the oceanic environment. So, you know, and not everyone's seeing this, but I just point out to you, Eagle One. You know, page 65 of the report, we start talking about the oceanic environment, and there's a graph there where we talk about oceanic influence of viscosity and friction. And the idea is that if I'm starting out in Pearl Harbor, Hawaii, and I'm beginning to move towards the Chinese coast, you know, I move from an environment that's very helpful to me, and my ships or carrier strike groups or independent sailors. But as I get closer, that there is a turnover point, as it were, where I'm entering China's sphere of influence. And as I move deeper into that sphere of influence, whether that's their range of their weapons or their sensory awareness, then, in fact, I am encountering greater and greater resistance to the flow of my influence into that region. And, yes, there are aspects of, you know, whether I'm going to get support from inorganic assets and so on that can lessen that resistance or friction in support of me. But there also is an idea that there's a temporal aspect of that's cyclic. They're not going to be there always. And so that in many ways what determines my presence value is simply my presence and how well I'm able to sustain that presence as I get deeper and deeper into the influence of the Chinese environment. Now, the one thing I can say, and it's in the graph that deals with this, when I'm talking about the different oceanic, is that when I'm operating in proximity to an ally, even though that ally is based deep inside the other guy's sphere. So, for instance, Taiwan. Let's view Taiwan or Japan as an ally, that when I'm operating in close proximity to them and their forces, to the degree that their interests are aligned with me and mine, then, in fact, I'm going to pick up some aided, you know, lessening of the friction to my presence there. I think certainly the idea of us moving through the Taiwan Strait is aided by the fact that the Taiwanese are interested in us and supportive of those operations, and so that sort of lessens the friction in those waters.
Yeah, Lee in comments just mentioned something that kind of bounced off what you were just talking about, you know, those things near in the far western Pacific that are close to China. And it ties into a brief mention that Admiral Fallon had in your interview is there weren't any ships available at all, but he was trying to create some positive effects in the Philippines, not unimportant, especially in the early part of the Zero Zeros, where I think we both have a mutual friend who was actually there with the special forces in the southern Philippines. There was a lot going on there, and he wanted to get some naval presence to get there. And he wanted to send, if you can't do anything else, can you deploy a hospital ship from San Diego to me? And he mentioned, you know, big Navy just didn't quite get it. And it's that amorphous blob. You know, we talk about national will. A lot of national will derives from understanding. And we hear, you know, big Navy thrown around a lot. And it's also, it's fun to hear that phrase used by a four-star because to 98.7% of people, he is big Navy. So when there are important leaders like a Navy four-star who's trying to get an important ally further inside our lifeline, who's under stress, not just from an Islamic insurgency, but from a surging China, and quote, big Navy, unquote, is throwing blocks in the way. who is this big Navy that can thwart four stars who are trying to do the right thing in such important areas?
Well, I think that comes down to OPNAV staff, or for that matter, political leadership that's involved in this. And yeah, the examples of using the hospital ships, they bring a tremendous amount of influence, and they have a very strong form of presence. But they influence in the local environment. So yes, they still talk about the hospital ship's visits to the southern Philippines, and it's something that we've continued to do in the years hence. So I don't mean to say that hospital ships don't have presence because they don't have Tomahawk, but I would say that their presence, has a different flavor to it. And also the half-life or the impulse that comes off from that presence mission has a lower amplitude than the presence that comes with the ability to project power. So I would fully use the two hospital ships, but I only have two hospital ships. And really, I only have the crew for one hospital ship to send it out there, which is one of the limiting factors. Gentlemen, because I know that we're coming up at the end of the hour here in just a few more minutes, I did want to highlight that in the conclusion that this report was deeply troubling to me as I got to the end because, I think it's suggestive of, in fact, that the value of our naval presence is really on a knife's edge right now, that because of declining perception of our national will and the combat credibility, let's face it, it's been, 70 years since there's been a major Navy sea battle, and also the declining size of our fleet, that in fact the value of our presence may be coming to an end. And I think that should be deeply troubling to policymakers and to navalists alike.
Yeah, that's a great point. And I think that probably you and Bob Work and a bunch of other folks have this same concern, which is the overuse of the fleet is not the fleet's problem, not the Navy's problem. It is a Department of Defense problem. Somebody has to say no to the COCOMs, and that's the only guy that can do it. And that not saying no is causing a lot of the problems that we're discussing, including the one you just mentioned.
Yeah, the thing that I worry now is that we actually may have had the moment when naval presence declined to the point that it no longer is effective, and that may have occurred some time ago, and we just haven't noticed yet. But it will quickly come to our attention the first time that Chinese Type 55 cruiser comes alongside a Burke and just pushes us out of the way and then says, what are you going to do about it? This is my water. You need to go away and don't come back. The point here is that we no longer have the numbers to service all of the requests that are out there for naval presence. And that, yes, we are breaking the fleet trying to do that. But until the Navy says no, or the COCOMs say more, 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 give me more ships, then political leaders are not going to free up the funds. And right now, obviously, you and I and everyone else knows the industrial base is not there to just pour it on and start, building more destroyers and submarines tomorrow. And so, we need to kind of come to grips with where really is naval presence crucial. I would submit that we need naval presence in the Western Pacific quite consistently. We need to create a fleet to provide presence in the Arctic, for instance, but we need to kind of look at other regions of the world. I think right now 8 of the 11 aircraft carriers are at sea, which means I am burning aircraft carrier utility right now. Everyone's going to have to go back in the yard in order to be ready for a real contingency if we don't start hurling some airplanes and weapons at the Iranians soon. We're going to need to get a reset in the carrier strike group, but we need a reset across the entire fleet.
And Jerry, kind of to end up the hour, we actually have a caller here, a friendly neighbor from area code 703 that might bring a little bit of a joint flavor. Area code 703, you are with Jerry. I have a question.
Thank you, sir. I appreciate it. I kind of had two, and it's in the same theme. The first being, Captain Hendricks, sir, you pointed out of how presence works episodically with a CSG or an ARD coming and going into a given theater. But what about the persistent presence of either the Army's multi-domain task force or the Marine Corps stand-in force, having those sensors and shooters, granted knowing that the range of certain systems might not necessarily always be in the best interest of that naval task force, but how does that kind of get pulled into the calculations when they come online or truly deployed, especially in the first island chain?
Well, it's an excellent question, and it actually came up in some of the studies of these operations other than war. And again, there was a growing perception that, in fact, it's the mobility of the force that sort of gives a sense of its fragility or its vulnerability as well as its lethality. And so the more land-based you are, specifically in the archipelagic areas of the Western Pacific, the more vulnerable you are perceived. And so the idea of presence declines under those cases. So that's not just me. There was these two studies that came out that looked at these operations other than war that sort of suggested that, you know, the concept of quote-unquote Army presence was stretched, in terms of its effectiveness, whereas the ability to rapidly enter and depart was viewed more positively. So the Navy and Marine Corps team was viewed as having more presence and influence because of its mobility, whereas the Army in many ways was viewed as less present and more of a factor of being there and then hence fading into the background noise because of the perception of their immobility. So to the degree that the Army today demonstrates that it can move and move quickly and remain mobile while also operating, then I think its presence score goes up.
Well, Jerry, good answer. We've used up the hour pretty thoroughly, I think. Before we go, though, tell us what you're working on, where people can find what you're doing, and what's next.
Well, the beauty of my situation as both a consultant and as a senior fellow is, you know, I've got about 9 irons in the fire right now. I'm currently working on another analytical product for an office inside the Pentagon. I've also got some proposals out to some grant issuing agencies on some other things I would like to study. I'm actually trying to broaden my base a little bit right now, looking not just at the industrial base and the Navy, but looking at some of the larger questions about defense policy and strategy. I'm getting up there in years, and I'm getting tired of talking about the same old thing. So I'm actually trying to grow and stretch as I tried to grow and stretch with this paper by doing math, which was hard for me. So right now I've got a full book for not only this year but next year of analysis and research, and I'll let you all know when the next paper comes out and make sure that Sal and you get early copies of it there too.
Well, Jerry, thanks a lot. It's been an absolute pleasure joining you with you again, and I hope you and yours have a great holiday season, and look forward to next time.
I look forward to it. Thank you both, Eagle One and Commander Salamander. It's a pleasure to talk with you and your audience.
Well, thank you, Jerry.
And thank you, everybody, for joining us for another edition of MidRats. And until next time, we hope you have a great Navy Day. Cheers.
Marry me and so leave the strand and Piccadilly.